This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. For over 75 years, the U.S. Social Security Administration, or SSA, has touched the lives of virtually every American. Whether it is after the loss of a loved one, at the onset of a disability, or during the transition from work to retirement. Today, however, SSA faces complex management challenges that are linked to the profound demographic and system changes happening in the country. It is at this historically critical juncture that SSA has sought to enhance its ability to meet its mission, eliminating claim backlogs, reversing negative trends, improving services, and demonstrating the nexus between adequate funding and the ability to deliver real and measurable progress. What is the Social Security Administration doing to reduce disability backlogs? How is SSA improving service and stewardship efforts? What does the future hold for the United States Social Security Administration? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Michael Astrew, Commissioner of the U.S. Social Security Administration. Michael, it's great to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you for inviting me back.
Also joining us from IBM is Nicole Gartner. Nicole, welcome. Always good to see you.
Always great to see you, Michael.
Michael, before we delve into specific initiatives, I'd like to understand a little bit more about the history and continuing evolution of the U.S. Social Security Administration.
We were founded in 1935, and we're one of the largest federal agencies. We have about 65,000 federal employees and about 16,000 state employees who work exclusively for us around the country. We have about 1,500 physical facilities. Most of them are field offices, but we also have offices for hearings. We also have offices that do a lot of our back office work to get make sure that particular types of checks get places, particular types of authentication get places.
So with such a critical mission, could you give us a sense of the operational footprint of SSA? How is it organized, size of its budget, geographical footprint?
Our headquarters is in has been in Baltimore from the beginning. It's a historical accident. It was the closest place to Washington, D.C., where they could find a building sturdy enough for the original equipment that we needed to print cards and that type of thing. So we originally started in the harbor area of Baltimore, and then in the 1950s moved to Baltimore County on the outskirts. We have a little over 11,000 people who work in headquarters. We're fairly hierarchical. We have a very large Deputy Commissioner for Operations office. About three-quarters of the employees work in what we call operations. We have 10 regional offices. It's the structure that we inherited from our former mother agency, HHS. So we have the exact same regional structure that they have, which has been pretty much has been unchanged, I think, since 1962. And those 10 regional offices have managers who supervise a handful of field offices. Those are called area directors. And then we have field office managers. We have about 1,250 field offices now, and every area director supervises a number of those. And most of the people who work for the agency are on the front line trying to help people in field offices. That's really where the bulk of our people are. But we have a whole range of people. We have actuaries in Baltimore. We have people who work on policy. We have about 4,000 people working in systems. We retain a lot of records. We are the largest repository of medical records in the world. And we have all the normal functions that any large organization has, people who do facilities and things like that.
So let's transition to you and the specific roles and responsibilities that you have. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're specifically responsible for? And also, can you tell us how does an SSA commissioner get selected? And what's the tenure for the post?
Sure. The responsibilities are very operational. There's been an understanding since we became an independent agency that some of the big policy issues on solvency are more properly handled by the Secretary of Treasury. So there are certain types of questions that I defer over to Secretary Geithner because that's the understanding these days. So the job is very operational. What a lot of people don't appreciate, because we're so associated with retirement, and that's where the bulk of the program money goes, the bulk of the administrative activity goes to processing. This year, it'll be about 3.2 million disability cases, and that's up substantially because of the recession, because there's this correlation. When times are hard, more people apply for disability, and it's very labor-intensive. It could be 1,000 pages of medical records. We have to go back over employment histories. It's a very labor-intensive, time-consuming thing. And for Title 16, which is the welfare disability program, we also have to go into detail on income and assets and that kind of thing. So it's very labor-intensive, and most of the actual work of most of the people is actually on disability, not on retirement. My term is a six-year term. It's, I think, among people that work on nominations, it's called a soft term rather than a hard term. So when my term is over, January 19th of next year, I don't have to leave immediately. I'm allowed to stay until a successor is confirmed. And I think that reflects an intent by Congress to try to maintain continuity. And I think the statute, which has its pros and cons, has been relatively successful on that. My predecessor was the first one under the independent agency statute, and she stayed just over 5 years. I hit 5 years on Sunday, and that's substantially longer than the history. I mean, part of the reason why we have the statute is that there were a lot of acting commissioners, a lot of commissioners staying for relatively brief periods of time. So the statute was an attempt to try to give the agency a little bit more continuity in operations.
So, Michael, regarding your responsibilities and duties and the number of demographic changes that are happening and the trends that the folks are facing, what are the three top challenges you're facing and how have you sought to address those challenges?
Well, certainly when I accepted the job, the biggest obvious challenge was getting ready for the baby boom. As I started, the National Academy of Sciences had just issued a report saying that the agency was woefully unprepared for the baby boom and needed to really improve electronic services in order to manage the workloads and those sorts of things. And then I came in, the agency was rejecting most of that advice, and I read that report and said, no, these people are pretty much right, and it became part of the blueprint for moving us forward. So we moved to get the best usability that we possibly could to reach out to new constituencies, and we've been very successful. The University of Michigan measures private sector and public sector electronic services. Most of the big organizations in this country use it. We have the three best in the federal government, four of the top five, and we do better than Yahoo and Google and places that most people would think would be better than we are. And so we're very proud of that, and it's allowed us to be much more efficient and to manage the baby boom, and that's why we did it. But it turned out that if we hadn't done that when we did it, we would have just been rocked back on our heels by the recession. Dealing with the added workloads of the recession has been hard enough as it is, but if we did not have the electronic services, we would have been moving backwards in terms of most of the metrics for serving the public. And we were able, despite the increase in workloads and the last 2 years, very severe budget cuts, we are still improving in terms of most key service metrics to the public. And the electronic services has really been a pivotal part of that.
So, Michael, I'd like to talk about your leadership style, get peer into that. What makes an effective leader? And more particularly, who has influenced your leadership style?
I think there have been a couple people that have influenced my leadership style. One of the CEOs at Biogen when I was there was a very strong, charismatic leader named Jim Tobin, who subsequently became CEO of Boston Scientific. And one of the things that he stressed, and my friend Charlie Baker, who ran the largest HMO in Massachusetts, stressed to me, is really being fearless in terms of communication. So many executives are afraid to say what's true. And I think that if you're going to have people follow you, they need to know what you're trying to do and why, and they need to believe it. It has to be authentic. And so one of the things that I've tried to do at Social Security, which is similar to what I did in the private sector when I was doing a turnaround of a biotech company, is really communicate very regularly and personally with the employees. And there was some real resistance to that at Social Security in the beginning. I mean, a commissioner's broadcast was a relatively rare thing, and it was conceptualized as only being for certain events, and it had always been said in the same way, and you really couldn't distinguish most of my predecessors. You know, you could put them on a table and you couldn't tell who had said them. So for whatever else you might say about me, I do have a somewhat distinctive style. And I think the people in headquarters all of a sudden said, you know what? That really is resonating with people. When he sends out a broadcast, it might not be the way I would say it, but they know it comes from him. And I think that that matters. And so, you know, now, you know, we're doing some fairly substantial shifts in resources because Congress looked like they were going to shift us very much into program integrity work. That passed both houses. They kept telling us this was going to happen. We geared up for it. We prepared for it. And then they did something radically different. So we're shifting. It's sort of rippling around the organization. And I think that I felt a very strong need to explain clearly and in detail to people what we were doing and why we were doing it. And I think that that's underestimated in terms of good leadership. So I think the most important thing in lots of ways is very regular, very clear, very candid communication.
What is SSA doing to reduce disability backlogs? We will ask Michael Astrew, Commissioner of the U.S. Social Security Administration, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What are the seven management imperatives all government executives need to know? How is DOD improving its business operations? What is FAA's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextJet? How is New York City shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And what about power, security, and leadership in the 21st century? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Michael Astrew, Commissioner of the U.S. Social Security Administration. Also joining us from IBM is Nicole Gartner. So, Michael, in the last segment, you mentioned that a good leader communicates their vision and how they're going to get there. So I'd like to turn our focus on the strategic plan you folks are developing and your five-year strategic plan. Could you give us a sense of the strategic vision that's outlined in the plan, some of the goals, but more particularly, give us some insight on how you went about developing it?
So I think the most important thing that we did for each of our strategic plans, particularly for the first one, was to improve our management information. We kept a number of statistics, in some sense too many, because if you asked a simple question as to how long does it take us to do X, you would get three or four different answers depending on which component in the agency was recording that. And we did not have standard definitions. And so we would talk past each other. We would confuse the Congress. You couldn't even really set goals in some sense because everybody was defining the task very differently. So one of the things that we spent a lot of the first 18 months doing was first making uniform the definitions for everything that was important in terms of defining whether we were succeeding or failing. And then when we got past that step, we were able to start asking, okay, what else should we be recording that we're not? And that's still an ongoing process. We got a couple more data elements that we're trying to get into our packages now. But what a manager at Social Security can do today is go on the intranet. There's a monthly report, comes in very quickly after the end of the month, that gives us the monthly and the annual numbers for how we're doing on everything that we think is important in terms of measuring performance, with a little color coding it to make it a little easier graphically, whether we're going the right direction or the wrong direction. And I think that's tremendously important. You have to be careful about managing just to metrics because you can have unintended consequences. And that's a mistake that a lot of rookie and poor managers make. And you have to remember that quality is always important, and that doesn't always show up in metrics. So we've made very conscious decisions to blow to pieces certain metrics progress that would impress the Congress, impress the outside world, in the name of quality. So, for instance, pending cases is an overrated way of measuring backlog because, you know, it doesn't matter how many people are in the line in the grocery store. What matters is how long it takes to get to checkout.
May I ask, though, to what extent is the fiscal realities of the day factored into your shaping your new strategic plan? Were the assumptions based on the realities?
They were, and I think it made it much harder. So the plan that we did in 08 was predicated on some realistic optimism about somewhat better congressional funding, and that was in fact right because we had 3 years where we did quite well with the Congress and was enormously helpful in terms of bringing down the backlogs. It was much tougher writing a strategic plan in the context of 2 straight years of budget cuts, losing 7,000 employees net over 2 years, because it's very hard to take on much in the way of new initiatives when you're just trying to hold on to kind of what you have. So we did the best we could with what we had. It's not as visionary and optimistic a document as the previous one, but I think it's realistic.
Over the last 4 years or so, how has your agency demonstrated the nexus between adequate funding and being able to achieve the mission? And what are the external factors that really affect whether you can meet your strategic vision and really aspire to achieve the mission?
Well, as you get toward the end of your term, you know, you do think a little bit, you know, what have I contributed? You know, have I lived up to my own expectations? And I think one of the areas where I've been able to make a significant contribution was to change the legislative strategy when it came to discussions about funding. The agency is a wonderful place, and they are some of the most motivated, can-do people possible. But I think for a long time, we went up to the hill with that sort of can-do attitude, and we really ended up hurting the agency and the people that we serve because we'd go up and we'd ask for what we thought we needed, and the response will be, well, that's nice, but can you do it with that minus 5%? And the answer is, well, it'll be a lot harder, but we're a can-do agency, we'll do it. So we did not want to tell the Congress what would not happen if they did not fund at a certain level. And we're so big and so complicated, we developed not only the very prominent disability hearing backlog, but lots of other backlogs, too, on work that is still very important to get done on a timely basis. And that was not discussed the way that it should have been. So going back to what I said earlier about clear, candid communication with employees, I may be wrong, but I'm consistent because I believe in exactly the same thing when it comes to communicating with Congress. And for a while, that worked extremely well. We had a 3-year stretch where we did, I believe, on average, better than any of the other large domestic agencies. Congress heard the concerns, decided that we were right, and responded. The last couple of years, you know, it's been mostly across the board funding, and I think that hurts us disproportionately for a couple reasons. One is Congress put what was essentially operating money into the Recovery Act and then didn't count that as part of our baseline going forward. So we started at a lower baseline than comparable other federal agencies. Second, we don't really have very much other than buildings and people in terms of expenses. So if you're a grant-making agency, you might not like it, but you can do 3% fewer grants and 3% less money, and you've got some flexibilities in responding to cuts. We don't have those. We have entitlements, we have people, we have buildings. And so what is happening, and I think Congress still is having trouble understanding the wreckage that it's creating, with these kinds of reductions in staffing, we have no real choice but to consolidate facilities. And so they all think that they've done the right thing when they vote at the funding level, and they talk about government becoming leaner, more innovative, and efficient. But then when you do the things to become leaner and more efficient, if it affects their districts, they become extremely upset. We're having a lot of unpleasant conversations with Congress because we are consolidating facilities. And it's not just the money we save by consolidating facilities. We can't hire We can't backfill employees. You know, we have to take hundreds of millions of dollars out of the budget, and it's hard. And so it's been a very difficult couple of years.
Well, Michael, I'd like to switch to a specific program, the disability program. And it would be nice for our audience to understand a little bit about it before we delve into some of the successes you've had in re-architecting it, if you will. What are some of the key steps in the disability process?
So I think the first thing is to realize we really have two programs, very similar in terms of their programmatic requirements. But one is an insurance program. It's something that all Americans are entitled to if they pay into the system. The other is a welfare system. It's income and asset-based. So we have Title II is the insurance program. Title 16 is the welfare program. And the basic standard is a person has medical impairments that prevent them from doing work that exists in the national economy for a period of 12 months or more. And what we've tried to do is to, A, use much more up-to-date medical information. When I started, we had regulations for significant areas of medicine that had not been updated since the 1970s. And I knew from biotech the world changes much more quickly than that. So now we're on a cycle where we're trying to keep them all updated at least every 5 years and more often if we can. And we're pretty much living up to that. The other thing is there had been an attitude in the agency generally that if diseases or conditions were much below the orphan drug line, those were sufficiently rare that we didn't have to provide terribly detailed guidance. But when you aggregate all those, that's an awful lot of the cases. It's where an awful lot of a disproportionate amount of the time, money, and effort were going, and it's where disproportionate error was. So one of the things that we've done is go into much more detail, into much less common diseases and conditions to address that. And we've also been able to fast-track a lot of the rare diseases and conditions by picking them out by computer in advance. And many of these are devastating, and there's no question that basically the diagnosis should allow an allowance of disability. And then there's a group where you have to do a limited review, but the overwhelming number of cases should be allowed. So we're pulling those out now in the front end. We're doing about 6% of our cases that way, and those are generally decided in sort of 10 to 15 days on average. So that's a big improvement. Before, when the machine went on automatic pilot for the standard cases, we'd ask for an enormous amount of medical evidence. We'd ask for an enormous amount of vocational evidence. If the disease or condition were obscure, we'd have to go out and try to get specialists to advise us on those things when really there was only one right answer. So that's all wasted effort. So that's, I think, been one of the great successes of the agency, and we've received some awards and things like that for the program, and other agencies are starting to look at if there are ways they can duplicate that with their programs.
So, Michael, SSA, and we talked about this, you mentioned before the increase in the disability and reconsideration claims as a result of the economy, which produces a backlog. In April 2010, you testified that SSA's plan is to reduce the initial claims backlog to a pre-recession level by 2014. Would you elaborate a little bit more on SSA's efforts to improve the timelines and the quality, and talk a little bit about something called quick disability determination and compassionate allowance? Tell us about that and some of the other initiatives.
Sure. So let me start by saying, you know, we have the states do the first two levels of review before we get into hearings and appeals. And, of course, the best way to solve any backlog problem is to the extent that you're making errors to pick them up quicker and earlier in the process. And we're doing a pretty good job of that. And one of the ways we've done it is we're using much more sophisticated software for structured review and prompting with examiners in the state level. It's a system we call ECAT. And that's had a substantial effect on improving quality. There are other things that you do to improve quality. But the other thing that we've done, I think, is fairly dramatically improved the system, is that we have two types of fast-track cases. We have the compassionate allowance cases, which are basically the cases where, by definition, you're disabled. You know that with medical certainty. And someone that has that confirmed diagnosis should just be given benefits as quickly as possible. So that's what we do. It's sort of a radical concept. But right now, about 1% of our cases and growing more rapidly are compassionate allowances. About 5% are QDD cases. And we think that number, we took an educated guess. It was largely my back of the envelope estimate with our 2008 plan that we could do 6 to 9% of our cases that way. Looks like we're going to hit the upper end of that range. We've been working with NIH, which has been very helpful. They're using some sophisticated programs and templates to identify diseases and conditions that look very similar on key dimensions with our current compassion allowances, and that looks like a very productive partnership. So we have as many as maybe 25 more that we're going to be announcing in the spring. And also when the economy recovers, the percentage of cases handled on the fast tracks will increase because almost none of the 600,000 or so extra cases we're getting that are recession-related fall into these categories. They're people that have medical challenges but had been working and a lot of times don't meet our definition of disability. So I think when the profile of cases goes back to something approaching economic normalcy and we do another round of expansions with a collaboration with NIH, we probably will be up around the 9%.
So just to continue talking about disability a little bit more, the timeliness and accuracy of SSA's disability decisions and the hearing at the adjudicated judge level is at the forefront of congressional and agency concerns, as it has been. What is SSA doing to eliminate the backlog of the hearings and prevent their reoccurrence, as well as how are you leveraging technology and enhancing the training for the judges?
A lot of this is really for the first time looking seriously at our hearings operation as an operation and you doing fairly basic things in terms of operations management. So we've moved to uniform business processes. We've asked the hard question and gotten consensus among the management judges. What's the best way to do certain things? You know, we had about 142 hearing offices, and there were at least 142 different ways of handling a lot of the things that we do over and over again. So although that was often an emotional and difficult process, we got a fair amount of consensus that there were certain best ways to handle cases. And so that has helped particularly some of our least efficient offices move up very quickly. We screen judges much more carefully than we did before. We never did background checking before. We've also had success in persuading the Office of Personnel Management to refresh the list on a regular basis. So I think we've hired very good people. We've checked their background carefully, so we think they're going to be responsible judges. I think we've improved morale. We've improved productivity. We've improved processes. We do a lot more with technology. So not only have we brought down the average wait to a hearing from about 540 days to about 340 days, we're much tighter around the mean. By the end of this year, because we also set targets for reducing the number of aged cases, the cases that have been waiting the longest, we will be able to look up and say nobody's waiting 2 years anymore, whereas 5 years ago we had people waiting 4 years.
Now, keeping on that line of thought around service enhancement, I'd like to understand how SSA is leveraging health IT and applying it innovatively to enhance service.
So what we've been very excited by health IT from the get-go, and the Recovery Act encouraged us to spend approximately $25 million getting ready for that. So we've done pilots. We work with MedVirginia. We work with a couple other of the smaller entities around the country that are pretty much already there in terms of supplying electronic medical records. And it's worked extremely well from our vantage point in time. It's not quite as well as we dreamed in the beginning because, you know, we discovered that what was coming over the transom had a lot of extraneous reimbursement information, other information we had to screen out, that we had to do some redesigns of our business processes to handle some of the information that was coming in somewhat differently. But even with those fixable problems, we were cutting our review times by probably in the neighborhood of about 40%. And I think we can do better over time. The problem for us right now is just very few insurers are there yet. It's coming, but it's painfully slow. I mean, there was tens of billions of dollars in the Recovery Act provided to the private sector to accelerate this. And it's coming, but it's slow. When health IT comes, your head is going to snap back and say, it's amazing how much things are changing. And it will be changing in a good way. So I'm excited about it. I mean, I'm a little frustrated because 5 years ago, I thought all the improvement would happen on my watch, and that's not going to happen. You know, at this point, it's going to be 3 more years probably before it's common enough in the private sector to affect most of what we're doing. But we're getting there.
How is SSA improving its service and stewardship efforts? We will ask Michael Astrew, Commissioner of the U.S. Social Security Administration, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is FAA's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen? How is the U.S. Department of Homeland Security turning its one DHS vision into reality? What is New York City doing to shape a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And how is the DoD improving its business operations? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Hear from FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, DHS Undersecretary for Management Raphael Boris, New York City Deputy Mayor for Operations Stephen Goldsmith, and Dave Winogrand, Assistant Deputy Chief Management Officer at DoD. Professor Joseph Nye and General Anthony Zinni on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century, and 7 management imperatives that government leaders should pursue to be successful in an era of fiscal constraint. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Michael Astrew, Commissioner of the U.S. Social Security Administration. Also joining us from IBM is Nicole Gartner. So, Michael, today SSA faces many challenges regarding the technology and infrastructure they have. I'd like to get a sense of what you're doing to address some of these challenges, i.e. data consolidation using the cloud.
So I think 5 years ago, we had a huge IT infrastructure problem. And again, because we weren't communicating with each other, we didn't even realize how bad it was. So we had a national computer center that was designed in the late 70s, built in the early 80s with a 20-year life expectancy that was getting close to 30 years old. And we were running out of capacity to put more servers in. And more ominously, the utilities were built in such a way, for instance, that the pipes for the cooling that we need, and we use an enormous amount of water, and we use an enormous amount of electricity, were built parallel. So after, you know, we have pipes built with a 20-year expectancy. So what happens is they start to corrode, they leak, and then they short into the system. So that's a real risk for us in addition to the facility just not having been built for today's technology and not having the capacity we need going forward. So we needed to move on replacement on that. We also, the agency had started building its first backup facility. And to think that an engine that pumps almost $70 billion a month into the national economy had no backup capacity is shocking. The backup plan in an emergency was to run to a commercial facility in New Jersey. You know, two field office managers would get the call, said run to the facility, reserve as much time as you could buy. The maximum that they could buy would be back up about 10% of our capacity, and the transition time to get up and running in New Jersey would have been very long. So the good news is that we've made substantial progress toward fixing both programs. We have a second facility now in the South that backs up 100% of our capacity. I was able to change the design of that really at the last minute, make some additional investment. So instead of backing up 50% of our capacity, it backs up 100%, and that's great. And we can now flip from one to the other in about 5.5 hours and then another 5.5 hours to test and make sure that we've done it right. And that's a huge improvement. Congress also, in the Recovery Act, approved the money that we need to build a new primary facility. And so that site has been purchased. Site preparation is ongoing, and we're planning on having the groundbreaking in April. So that's a longer-term project, but that will allow us to meet our base needs. We've been a little careful about the cloud for security reasons, and it's also just capacity reasons. Are we running one of the largest computer systems in the world? We have days where the way that the systems people measure transactions, where we have 800 million transactions. It's a huge facility.
So there was a study done by the Partnership for Public Service and the Center for the Business of Government called From Data to Decisions, the Power of Analytics. How is SSA demonstrating measurable improvements by using analytics? How are you using analytics? And what are some of the data-driven decision-making that you've been using over the last few years?
Sure. So let me give you a couple examples of new and interesting things that we're doing. So we have a tremendous new tool that was developed pretty much skunkwork style, which I'm proud of by some people, called policy feedback. And so we are now able with this tool to snake very efficiently through our own records to find out exactly sort of what's happening. So 5 years ago, you came in and said, well, you know, do we have an issue with the accuracy of our determinations in colon cancer? Because it looks like it's very different in some parts of the country than the other. Well, there was no very efficient way to do that except to ask the Inspector General or the Office of Quality to do a pretty labor-intensive study. We can now sit in front of a computer and very quickly push a button, find where the outliers are, and then go in case by case in the outliers. So in the example, the demonstration I saw, where there were some outlier statistics for head and neck cancer, we were able in probably about half an hour to go in and look at the individual case files in three or four of the states that were outliers. And it was pretty clear to someone who was not a trained examiner, such as me, that there was confusion between esophageal cancer and head and neck cancer. And so we could say, okay, we need to go. We need to clarify for those states how they're supposed to be handling things. So that kind of thing we're doing more and more of, and it's very exciting. Another thing that, you know, we did, we had a time-honored algorithm for allocating staff in field offices that a number of our people were very attached to, and they felt, you know, was almost unchallengeable. But, you went out into the field and you looked at what happened and you saw that there were certain disparities and that things weren't adding up and that there were some offices with almost no waiting room traffic and some that were backed up, you know, terribly. And I started to see, I thought some patterns there. So really made people go back over about a 12-month period and bang away on to challenge the algorithm to see where the waiting room traffic was and to see why we saw these disparities. And sure enough, at the end of the project, we could see that the algorithm had not changed and adapted to changes in the SSI program from 1974. And the SSI work is very labor intensive. And it gets more labor intensive every year because Congress has not put an inflation adjustment on the asset and resource limitations. So every single year, it is more labor intensive to do SSI cases than the year before, but our algorithm hadn't changed in 20 plus years. And so I try to be a catalyst for asking those types of questions and using the enormous wealth of information that we have to try to address problems that we can see or suspect in our systems.
So still on the theme of citizen services, what has SA been doing to transform the customer service function, and to what extent are you expanding the availability of online and web capabilities?
So With all due respect to all the other federal agencies, we're clearly the leader when it comes to electronic services. And I mentioned the Michigan studies that confirm that. And so we are embracing this very enthusiastically. We embrace usability. We not only have an office that specializes in it, we have outside contractors look at it. And for anyone that's significant, I make them run it through for me personally, and I pick away at it too before it goes up and online. And I think that's made a big difference for us. We're trying to do things that people thought were not possible before. So, for instance, one of our most popular services is any American can go online at socialsecurity.gov and get a personalized estimate of their retirement benefit. And it not only, you know, with the old paper statement that went out, we just gave you one number that was based on one retirement age. And that's helpful, but in some ways it's also a little counterproductive, because part of the goal of the exercise is to get people thinking about their alternatives, not just thinking about one date. So what we've also tried to do is move away from sort of guiding people towards early retirement, which is effectively what we were doing, in my opinion, to being less directive, but giving a lot more information and giving people, for the first time, the opportunity to run retirement scenarios. So if you're trying to figure out your planning, you can sit in front of your own computer and you can say, how much would I get if I retire at 62? How much at 65? How much at 70? And while that's important for people like me, it's more important for people like you, because statistically you're probably going to live 6 years longer than me. And so when we look at the growing number of the older aging population, people in their 80s, 90s, and increasing number of centenarians, they're heavily female. And so if a woman makes a bad choice at the retirement, it's probably something that she's going to have to live with a lot longer than if I make a bad choice. So we're trying to get people thinking about those things, but not necessarily telling them what to do. Another thing that we do in that regard with the estimator, and this was actually, we got some great input from our British colleagues on this, is people have a tendency to underestimate their life expectancy by about 5 years, which also could make you make a bad choice. So we now have a rudimentary lifetime estimator as well, right there with the retirement estimator. So you can not only think about how much money you would get at certain ages, you can plug in personal information and see statistically how long you might be able to live. At least it plants the thought that maybe you ought to be planning for living a little longer than you might think that you would live.
So we talked a little bit about the fiscal constraints that exist today. And it, obviously, in a situation where there are all these difficulties, the style of the leader is very important. You mentioned your distinct style before. Reflecting a little bit on your leadership of SSA, can you tell us how you keep your employees focused and motivated in the face of some of these really pretty tough challenges and changes that you have to make?
Well, I think the most important thing is treating them with respect. I mean, I think that, you know, this is a group of people who are extremely talented. They could have done other things with their lives. In general, they've come to the agency because they're very attached to the mission. And so, to a large extent, you know, they run on that. And I think the most important thing in a lot of ways is kind of not getting in the way, you know, not tying them down with bureaucracy, not saying things that damage morale, and making them feel that they are making an impact by telling them what the agency is doing overall. So those, I think, are the most important things that we try to do.
What are you doing to make sure you have a highly trained and competent workforce?
So we have tried to do several things. One is we've expanded our outreach a little bit. I think that we had sometimes in some parts of the country been too narrow in our hiring. And because money came unpredictably and you often have to hire quickly, I think it's a little harder, for instance, to recruit disabled employees under those sort of circumstances. So we've had special programs to make sure that when we can hire, that we have pools that reflect our expectations in terms of a diverse workforce. And so I'm quite proud of the fact that when the Recovery Act money came, we hired about 20% of the agency in a year and a half, and we did extremely well on any objective metric of diversity, including disabled hiring, where we're basically the best in the federal government except for the EEOC. I think planning and being prepared on the hiring. We've also recognized that our main source of hiring is coming up from the grassroots, from the field, and I think that's good, and I think that will always be that way. But we've also said, you know, there are certain areas where we probably need to be a little bit more aggressive about getting in some people with a different kind of background and a different kind of perspective, particularly in the systems and IT areas. So we've started a program called the Hardy Apfel Fellowship Program, where we only hire from the top 15 IT graduate programs. And, you know, we actually had some skepticism internally, given that, you know, with civil service restrictions, we can't offer very much money and very much in the way of anything that would look as a perk. I mean, we actually present FaceTime with me as one of the perks. So, you know, go figure that might work. But, you know, the first year, we got a very talented group, but we weren't turning away top-notch people. The program's really caught on because we're taking in about 9, and we got 32 applicants. We turned down remarkable people from Caltech and MIT and stuff because the class is so strong. So I think what those people will do, where typically our systems people started in the field and learned systems later in their career or more recently came in from a contractor, these are going to be, I think, the people that are going to be our big think IT strategic planners of the future. And so far, it seems to be going well. We've only lost one since we started the program, and they're great individuals. And they challenge our people a little bit. You know, they're confident, as they should be, because they're very good. And they look at our world a little differently than we have. And that's a healthy tension for us. And I think that a significant number of these young people are going to be, you know, the top leaders of the agency 10, 20 years down the road.
But what does the future hold for the U.S. Social Security Administration? We will ask its commissioner, Michael Astrew, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Each edition of the Business of Government magazine has as its focus the core mission of the IBM Center, connecting research to practice as a means to improve public management. We do this by bringing together insights and perspectives blended with an equal measure of practicality and reflection from an array of government leaders, public managers, thinkers, and practitioners. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. In an era of fiscal contraction, today's leaders face unique challenges that present many difficult choices. It is a period that, while imposing many constraints, simultaneously confers as many opportunities to make a difference, introduce new ways of managing, explore pragmatic approaches, and pursue management imperatives that help government leaders perform in an ever-challenging, complex environment. In our latest edition, we bring you conversations with FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, outlining the Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen. Rafael Boris, DHS Undersecretary for Management, discusses how the department is turning its one DHS vision into a reality. Stephen Goldsmith, Deputy Mayor for Operations for the City of New York, discusses how the city is shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and efficient. We offer perspectives on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century from Professor Joseph S. Nye Jr. and General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command. Our forum presents 7 management imperatives that government leaders must pursue to be successful in this new environment. All of this and so much more in the Spring-Summer 2011 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Michael Astrew, Commissioner of the U.S. Social Security Administration. Also joining us from IBM is Nicole Gartner. Michael, I have the pleasure to talk to many of my guests about the use of collaboration and partnerships among federal agencies and the private sector to achieve mission and program outcomes. I'm wondering, how is SSA leveraging both a collaborative environment but also partnerships to do this?
Sure. So with all due respect to a number of the agencies that we partner with, I think the one that has been the most remarkable and most helpful for us in recent years is under the memorandum of understanding we have with the National Institutes of Health. So particularly with our fast-track disability programs, not only for each of the public hearings have they sent a senior person there to help us work through the testimony, ask the right questions, think about the diseases and conditions in the right way. They've done a remarkable research program recently where they've been taking the information in our databases, profiling the diseases and conditions of the fast tracks, and comparing them to diseases and conditions in other databases that they access to say, what else looks like those? Maybe these are the things that Social Security ought to be adding to the list. Because, you know, we had a lot of the low-hanging fruit in the beginning. We hit 100 diseases and conditions last year. You know, I'm hoping to double that in the next couple of years. But it's getting slower and harder because we've done the easy ones. But they came in just with their preliminary results a couple months ago, and it rocked my head back. I mean, they had 25 diseases and conditions that on not just the initial look, but now as we work through it more carefully, most of those are going to be compassion allowances. So that's going to accelerate our progress with the program enormously. There'll be tens of thousands of Americans, I'm persuaded, by the end of the year who will be getting the benefit of the fast track because of the partnership with NIH. So they've just been absolutely top notch, and I can't say enough good things about what they've done for us.
SSA has continued to be recognized as a great place to work in the federal government. I know you're really proud of that, and you talked a little bit about this impressive program in the last segment with the IT professionals. What can you tell us about what contributes to that great place to work? That's an impressive achievement, and where would you put the credit for getting that great reputation?
Well, I think most of it is the history and the tradition and mission of the agency. We traditionally have been a great place to work. We had slipped a little bit in recent years. We had slipped out of the top 10 on the partnerships list, but we're happy to have been back the last 3 years and aspire to do even better because, you know, I am very competitive. And I think, you know, as we've looked at what we've done and why, I think it goes back to the first question, Michael, that you asked, is I think the fact that we communicate better than we have before is the biggest thing, perhaps, that we've changed in terms of employee satisfaction. I can't change the salaries. I can't change the working conditions in most cases very quickly. I can't change too much the people that they work with and the attitudes or anything that they come in with. A lot of things I can't change. But what I can change is the sense that, you know, there are people at headquarters that are very committed to supporting what they're doing, are concerned about they're doing their work well, doing it efficiently, making sure they're secure in the workplace. And to, as we make changes to address those goals, to explain what we're doing and why. And so I think it's not only the understanding of the particular things that helps, it sends a general message that we have a culture that is not self-satisfied, that realizes it needs to focus on continuous improvement, and that it values the mission. And I think that if you're on the front line, knowing that the people 12 layers up believe in that, I think that's the most important thing that you can do in most ways.
So, Michael, you're 5 years into a 6-year term. What are you most proud of in terms of what you've done, and what do you want to be your legacy as commissioner?
Well, you know, people have been asking me that with more regularity. And part of what I try to do is try to get people a little less focused on that. You know, I jokingly refer to legacy as the L word around the office. And the reason for that is I think in a lot of agencies, because I've spent almost 14 years in the federal government now, and I've seen a lot of agency heads. And I've seen, as you get to the end, sometimes a sense that, oh my God, I have to establish my legacy, and things are raced out at the end, and they don't work very, and they're actually counterproductive. And a lot of times people actually, ironically, end up with a negative legacy because they're too worried about legacy. So my feeling is, I think that we've done some very